Hello, this is Monocle Reads. I'm Georgina Godwin. My guest today is Andrew Hankinson. He's a journalist who was born, raised and lives in Newcastle-upon-Tyne, which is in the north of England. He started his career as a staff writer at Arena magazine and he's won a Northern Writers Award. He's now a freelance feature writer who's contributed to many publications, including The Observer magazine, The Guardian and The New Yorker. He's the author of the CWA Dagger-winning You Could Do Something Amazing With Your Life, You Are Raoul Moat. It's an extraordinary book and I hope that we'll talk about it a little bit later on. But right now we're here to speak about Don't Applaud, Either Laugh or Don't, at the Comedy Cellar. So this is your latest book and it really has, I guess, two main characters in it. Tell us about Manny Dwarman.
Sure. So Manny Dwarman, he was born in Palestine and in the 1930s he got a ship over with his family to New York. He did a variety of jobs and then opened up this kind of coffee shop in Greenwich Village in 1960, which he played folk music there, and these folk musicians used to play there, including people like Bob Dylan and stuff. But then in the 1980s, he turned his folk club into a comedy club. And he loved being around these comedians, and he liked the way that they were honest and they would say what they thought and nobody got too offended or too upset. He had a back table at this comedy club where he used to kind of encourage the comedians to come round and discuss politics and debate with each other and engage in robust humour as well. But he was an Israeli guy, but he would also encourage, you know, Muslim Egyptians to come and sit around the table. So he hired a lot of Muslim Egyptians and Palestinians as well. And he would encourage them to come and sit around the table and they would discuss the Middle East and have these big arguments about the Middle East. And he was kind of libertarian, had some right-wing views, and he would encourage left-wing comedians and left-wing staff to come and sit around this table as well. And he just encouraged this, people have described it as like a salon, and he just encouraged people to come around and just argue and debate. And you would do it that day and people would get upset maybe a little bit, but the next day they would come back and do it again.
And after he died, his son Noam took over and really continued with that work.
Yes, exactly. So Manny died in 2003 and then Noam inherited the club. And he's so a lot of the book is about him trying to kind of maintain that ethos and encourage people to sit around and debate and argue and joke and things at this back table in his club. But he's having to do it in slightly more difficult times because of the greater scrutiny from social media and because, you know, culture's changing more rapidly, I feel, at the moment. So he's trying to do it in more difficult times and he's come in for greater flack because of it. And also it was during his stewardship that Louis C.K., one of the comedians who regularly performs there, Louis C.K. was exposed by the New York Times in 2017 for past sexual misconduct. But Noam decided to allow Louis C.K. to continue performing after about 11 months out, I think, to start performing again at the Comedy Cellar on the stage. So suddenly Noam was under the spotlight of global media and written about in places like the New York Times and Hollywood Reporter and by the BBC and things like this. And he had to defend his position of why he allowed Louis C.K. back on stage. And it kind of it meets together with his views on free speech and freedom of expression and all these sorts of things, where he feels even if someone, you know, has done something wrong, they should be forgiven. Even if someone disagrees with them, they should be allowed to have their say and things like this.
Mm. And that's really the key part of the book. What is funny? What's toxic? Who gets to decide?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the whole point of the book, which is, you know, I'm using this comedy club as a way to kind of reflect society. And the whole point of this book was deciding, you know, how do we decide who can and can't speak? And how do we decide what they can and can't say? And what I do is I kind of go backwards from this current controversy of Louis C.K. being allowed back on a stage. And I go backwards and show, you know, how, you know, there's things that used to be said. So, for example, I've got Will Silvince in there, who talks about the jokes that people used to make about Haitians in the 1980s and these kind of horrible jokes and how it felt when people were making these kind of jokes and stuff. So what I do is, you know, people kind of complain about political correctness now. So I wanted to go backwards and show why we have political correctness, because we don't want to go back to the way it used to be, which is when people said these horrible things and made these horrible jokes. So we're always progressing. And then it's just trying to examine how we progressed, why we've progressed, and whether we're still progressing in the right way.
I mean, when you look back at sort of, I don't know, mother-in-law jokes or racist jokes and that sort of, that generation of many of them northern comedians, I mean, they played to packed houses, to people who roared with laughter. Has our sense of humour changed?
You know, I don't know. And I don't know whether people still would be laughing at that if it was more in the mainstream, whether the people would still find that funny. I used to think that, you know, our sense of humour had changed, but now I'm not so sure. One of the people I interview in there, this guy, Andy De La Tour, who's a British alternative comedian, but he went to the Comedy Cellar and he kind of wrote some stuff about the Comedy Cellar. So that's why I spoke to him. But he talks about how those kind of comedians that you're talking about, they used to be dominant, but then the alternative comedians in Britain came along in the 1980s. And the interesting thing about them was they didn't try and shut down the other comedians. They didn't picket them and they didn't, try and get them banned from anywhere or anything like that. All they did was set themselves up with their own venues and they started to attract their own audience. And then they showed that they were actually really funny and they came to dominate. And I think that was interesting when he was telling me about that, because it showed that's the way they did it back then. But now there seems to be this thing where people want to some of the American comedians, they tell racial jokes and things like this, or you could say racist jokes. And rather than kind of trying to set up an alternative audience, it seems like people are trying to shut them down and just get them banned or, you know, write horrible things about them online. So I'm not sure if that's the best way to go, because that kind of seems to divide rather than just, you know, take the spotlight away from them.
Absolutely. I mean, cancel culture does seem to be becoming more and more prevalent. I mean, as we see through the story of Louis C.K., do you think that it's right that people should be just told to shut up, to be cancelled?
I don't know. I think you've got to make a case why you disagree with someone. And I mean, I don't know if people are getting told, oh, shut up, you can't say that. But what is happening is people are, I think people are becoming very worried about what they say. And even if it might be a reasonable opinion or something you can back up, people are worried about saying it. And I think that's not a great place to be, especially with, you know, there's quite a bit about in the book about this, about mobile phones and stuff like this. So now, you know, someone could film you saying something, doing something, and just take that out of context and put it on the internet. And we've seen that, you know, people's lives being destroyed. John Ronson wrote a great book about, you know, public shaming. And it's like, so I think that's one of the problems with these comedians on the stage, is they're kind of worried about what they say on stage, because they might be trying to work out a joke. It might not be there yet. Or there might be a bit at the beginning of the joke and a bit at the end of the joke. But if someone takes that middle bit where they're taking like an exaggerated position, or they're taking, you know, they're saying something transgressive to make a point, someone can take that and put it on the internet, and then that person's career can be severely damaged, you know. So I think it's a shame. One of the reasons I wrote the book is I kind of think it's important to have these comedy clubs, these rooms where comedians can go and say some outrageous stuff and, you know, experiment and try and get to the joke so that it can work in the mainstream. But if we take away those small rooms, and those small rooms are, you know, scrutinized too much, then I think it'll be a sadder place for it. And I don't think it's a healthy place for a society to be.
It's a fascinating book, as was your last one. Let's talk about your book. It's a cult classic. You could do something amazing with your life. You are Raoul Moat. Now, Raoul Moat, of course, was a murderer.
Yeah.
Tell us more.
So I'm from Newcastle. Raoul Moat is from Newcastle. And in 2010, he came out of prison and he shot his ex-girlfriend. And she survived, but he shot her new boyfriend as well, and he was killed. And then he went and shot a police officer as well, and that police officer was blinded and then later killed himself. And then Raoul Moat went on the run in Northumberland for like a week, and it became a national news story, and people were following it on this rolling news. And then eventually he was found by a river near Rothbury, and he shot himself. So with that book, it was all about this kind of split between some people who felt sympathy for him and then some people who thought he was just a callous murderer, end of story, like the Prime Minister David Cameron said. And I wanted to go back and just look at his life and sort of see why he'd ended up doing what he did, and see, how much he was responsible for his own actions and how much he wasn't responsible for his own actions. And to do that, it was like investigative journalism where you're just gathering documents and gathering recordings and, you know, and also court reporting and things like that as well, and interviewing people to try and piece together this story, which I then told in second person from his point of view, where it started from him being released from prison, and then you followed him for the whole week, and he reflected on his life and reflected on the things he'd done and ended up with his death. And then it was up to the reader to kind of decide whether they still felt sympathy for him by the end of it, considering the fact that he'd killed someone and shot three people.
Yeah. And how do you get into the head of someone like that?
Well, I mean, in the couple of years before he died, he started recording himself. So listening to those audio recordings, there was also when he was on the run, when he was initially on the run hiding in Northumberland, he had two accomplices with him, who were then was sent to prison for 20 years and 40 years. And one of those accomplices got him a dictaphone and some dictaphone tapes. So he started recording himself while he was on the run. So this was after he'd shot three people, he started recording himself. So from that as well, seeing what he said in that, he also wrote a letter while he was on the run. So using kind of the material in that letter to see what he was saying. And then also, so I became acquainted with his brother, and I ended up interviewing his brother quite a lot of times, and we kind of went for a walk in Rothbury to talk about Raoul. And then also his brother kind of had all the documents that Raoul had left behind in his flat, so in his house. So I used all these documents, which are things like business documents and stuff and legal letters and all this sort of stuff. And I used all that. So I had piles and piles of material and hours of recordings of him. And I just sort of plucked out the stuff that I thought was most telling and most interesting, and put that together in the book.
A huge work of investigative journalism. Now, you've reported from all over the world, from Haiti, from Iraq, from Ukraine, and done this huge variety of subjects. I understand now that you're working on a piece about race and immigration in Sunderland.
Yeah, well, that's actually a PhD at Northumbria University, and it's a creative writing PhD. And that's basically, I really got interested in poetry while I was doing a master's at Newcastle in creative writing, people like Carolyn Forshay and stuff. And so I started looking at whether I could kind of report using, prose poetry, really. So I started for this PhD, it's kind of been for the past 3 years, going to Sunderland to kind of look at what's been happening there. Because people like, Nigel Farage visited, Tommy Robinson's run a couple of campaigns there. There's been a lot of stuff going on. And I've been, interviewing refugees and interviewing asylum seekers, interviewing people who used to march with the English Defence League and stuff like this. And also just, going on the marches as an observer, making notes that have been going on through the city. And also there was a guy who used to make speeches in Sunderland who... He got locked up last year. He got imprisoned for the speeches that he was making because he got found guilty of stirring up racial hatred. So going to his trial as well and watching his speeches and things. There's a lot going on in Sunderland, and it's kind of illustrative of stuff that's going on across the country. So I was kind of really interested in that. And what I'm trying to do at the moment is turn that into some kind of narrative book-length piece of work, but using kind of essay, it's like a hybrid work, so essay, personal essay, as well as, prose poetry and like kind of bits of reportage and stuff like that.
Yeah, that sounds absolutely fascinating. Andrew, before you go, I just wanted to ask you about politics insofar as it affects the north of England, because in the last election, of course, we saw the Conservative Party take over many of Labour's seats. Why do you think the north has changed its political focus?
Oh, crikey. Well, I do think there's a feeling that, and it's very difficult to sort of say this without sounding incorrect, I suppose. But I do think there's a feeling that the North East, I can only really speak for the North East, but the North East felt slightly ignored and slightly left behind. But I think particularly over the past sort of 10 years, really, there was a period when we were getting new art galleries and new art and money was being spent up here, and then it felt like it wasn't so much. And I think maybe people felt a little bit left behind, and it felt like maybe we didn't have such powerful MPs up here anymore, which we did for a period. So people felt like people weren't really speaking for them.
Mm-hmm. And your hopes for the future there? I mean, do you think that we are going to see a resurgence of that part of England?
I've just written a piece about the Metro Centre, actually, which is all looking at kind of the last time people had big ideas for how to fix the Northeast, and that was looking at Sir John Hall and how the Metro Centre was going to kind of revitalise the area. And it seems like, well, it seems like the Metro Centre didn't really go anywhere in the end and hasn't achieved what we hoped it might achieve. And to be honest, that piece ends with me not knowing what we're going to do. And nobody I speak to really seems to have any plans for what we're going to do or where it's going to go. So I don't know what's going to happen to the Northeast. And I certainly worry about it now, particularly with all the stuff that's been going on with, you know, coronavirus and stuff. It's going to make it even worse. So and Brexit. So, yeah, I don't know where we're going to go. And I wish somebody had an answer, and hopefully somebody might step up with an answer at some point.
Well, it's been absolutely fascinating speaking to you, Andrew. Andrew Hankinson's book, Don't Applaud, Either Laugh or Don't, at the Comedy Cellar, is published by Scribe, and it's out now. You've been listening to Monocle Reads. Many thanks to the production team of Nora Hull and Charlie Filmer Court. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.